Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guest today is Leonard Phillips, who is the owner of Ambassador Wines and Spirits in Midtown, which opened 43 years ago. Leonard took over the business in 2008 and made it into one of the best liquor stores in New York City. The James Beard Award-winning website, Serious Eats, describes Ambassador Wines and Spirits as, "Do go to this shop when you are seeking out something unusual or obscure, or when you want to stumble upon something entirely new to you. They taste every product before it's sold at the shop. This policy means that Ambassador team makes thoughtful personal recommendations. And Ambassador is the liquor store I wish I had in my neighborhood. You find yourself wanting to hang out there, even if you don't really need to buy anything. And Ambassador has a huge collection of sake and shochu. So today we'll talk about how the American sake and shochu market has changed in recent years, why more people are buying sake, and how to pick a good sake, and much, much more. Hello, Leonard. Welcome
Hello.
To Japanese.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, please tell us about Ambassador Wine and Spirits. And as I said earlier, it sounds like it's a very special liquor store.
We're very unusual. Just to lay the groundwork, in New York, every market is different. New York market is very unique in that we can only own one store. Other states, you'll see chain operations. Mm-hmm. People can use scale to bring product to the market more efficiently. We can't. Mm-hmm. So given the fact that everybody supposedly is independently owned and operated, you have to be very unique. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that we have is that the unwritten rule is that half or more than half lately of the stores in the market are owned by the same people under different names. And the result is sort of a generic kind of cookie cutter store. And we've always not approved of it. So one of the things we do is we go against the marketing machines that are out there that cater to this type of store. And one of those things is sake. It's something that I have a passion for. I have a passion for all food and beverage. I met John Gottner, which a lot of people know in the sake industry.
Right. About, who came on the Japanese too.
That's right. About 20, I'd say, oh my God, close to 20 years ago. Mm. And he introduced me. And since then, I was hooked.
Wow.
So we started as one of the things I wanted to do is create a comprehensive section of sake. I looked out there and said, nobody's really doing it. Mm. I'd say the only place was in New Jersey at the time. And nobody who had any sake really was treating it properly. We wanted to showcase it and showcase it properly. So we have a walk-in refrigerator. Mm. This is indicative of what we do in just about everything.
Okay.
We're thorough. We want to have a good representation. So if I have a section of Portuguese wine, there's going to be a very large cross-section. It's not simply, oh, I have 5-6 wines to represent that country. Mm. We have over 4,000 SKUs in our store. And
wow.
It's a lot. It
right.
really is. But there's a reason for it. We taste everything. My staff and I, we sit down. Again, we're not just buying things that sell. We want to have a reason for having it. And we also have a very, and this will appeal to the people who are listening, who are in our industry, because we stand alone and we are a single entity. We work with people who give us the best price on very small quantities. And sake in particular is excellent at this. Whether it's cultural or it's the way sake is sold in Japan and then they came here, we can get the best prices within about 5% on small quantities. So I know when I sell it to my customer.
So it sounds like you have a good trust.
Yeah.
You know, trustful relationship.
When I sell it to my customer, I know I'm going to give them a very fair price. You know, it's one thing when you look at a big store, and I use a store that I look up to tremendously, like Astor, who is a single entity, who is a very large store. Their ability to purchase goods is much higher than mine. You know, I would need 10 of my stores to do what they do, maybe 15 in volume. So with that, they have scale. And if you take an item that gives discounts based on that scale, you can't compete with people like that. So we're very cautious about that. And sake is just perfect for us because there really isn't a great deal of discount. I think that's cultural. You know, the old saying, if you can't give the best deal in the beginning, then you're not quite trustworthy, you know? And so I think that follows through in the way sake is sold in the United States.
And also I think the actual supply of sake producers, like artisanal sake producers, they can't cut the price because they are already very thin.
They're very thin. And I think they understand that they want distribution. They want to get into as many places as they can. And as a result, they want to make it easier for stores to purchase. So right now, because it's on the rise, but not as popular as other beverages, I think you're going to see that across the board, no matter where you go.
Okay. So we'll talk about more sake specifically, but before we go in there, I heard that you have a very unique background before you go into your family business. So could you tell us about that?
I'm a molecular biologist, geneticist by trade. I graduated Stony Brook University. I was going to be a military physician. How I got from there to here is a very long and evolved road. But my background in chemistry and in biology really helps me in understanding the beverages that I taste. You know, we had talked earlier and I was mentioning to you that anyone who tastes the volume of items that we taste in a single day will become very, very good over time. But the reasons behind what we're tasting, why things taste the way they do based on how they're made, that's where the academics and my background really helps me. It's when you understand the chemistry in the fermentation and you understand how different fermentation methods are affecting the flavor, it is an advantage. There is no doubt. So not to bore everybody, I went from graduating and did many things, ran laboratories and did some research. But I found my niche in what I find is my passion, and that's what I do right now.
Interesting. So I'm really curious at that part. You know, the biochemistry applied to say like sake, right? So the fermentation, what's the difference? Like,
well, many people don't realize that sake is so unique in that it is fermented, and then it goes through a second process, very much like, or actually I say it's brewed, then fermented like wine. And there are so many ways you can affect change in the process. I mean, all your home brewers will be jumping up and down when they say, oh, I can do this and I can do that and I can change it. What's great about sake world, that there are very good definitions for the products. You'll see Komoto method, Yamahai method. These are all different methods of fermentation, and they have to do with timing, temperature. All these things come into play.
Right. It's like versus natural yeast versus correct, artificial yeast and all the process and how the labor
absolutely
interrupts.
We see it in wine when we think of Shizuku or a trickle method. That's analogous to free-run juice in wineries. non-pressed free-run juice. So there are many crossovers from the traditional wine industry and sake. But I think the toughest part for a New York retailer, because we are separate from beer in the New York market. In the United States, every market has its own rules. In New York, retail wine and spirits stores cannot sell beer. That's a grocery item.
So it's
a little more difficult for retailers in New York to grasp sake, because I think it's definitely more foreign to them than any other beverage. I think it's a much easier transition if you're a beer, if you sell beer, than just plain wine and spirits, because I think there's a tremendous amount in common, and it has to do with storage. You know, we have a walk-in refrigerator. A typical store in New York really doesn't make that effort, but they have to understand that many of the sakes are unpasteurized. And, you know, the same reason is the reason why recently New York retailers were able to start to sell in a large scale ciders. For many years, ciders were almost exclusively grocery, with the exception of a few. Many of the cideries had complained that the grocers weren't buying the craft stuff. They were buying the regular items. So you can see how cider and sake have had their problems in this market because of the way it's separated. The licenses are separated.
So same as not just sake, but wine. Like, you know, if you beer and wine side by side, probably they convert to each other, right?
Yeah, it's a little easier. You go to New Jersey, for instance, and everybody knows, you know, places like Matsuo. You know, it's a natural. I mean, they're a very large market.
The Japanese market, the largest in this country, I think.
I think it's probably the largest. There may be some in San Francisco. I know the West Coast has some pretty large markets. But the rules are different. They can sell everything. You know, in our industry, you know, many retailers look at someone like the Wine Library in New Jersey. They can sell cheese. We can't do that. And it's anytime I can find something that we can sell that makes us unique as an owner. And of course, if we have passion for it, it's even better. We want to bring that to the market whenever we can, because we are so limited into what we can bring.
Right. Okay. And of course, the Ambassador Wine Spirits is known for its super extensive, high quality products, and you know, range from wine, whiskey, and craft spirits, not to mention sake and shochu. So, what is your philosophy or strategy in selecting products?
Again, one of the most important strategies is, do we like it? Is it correct? We always talk about varietal correctness in wine, and that extends itself throughout our selections. Is it correct for what it should be? When someone picks up a Cabernet, does it taste like a Cabernet? Is it correct? That's one thing. The second one is the economics. We talk about, I want to make sure that I'm competitive. And I'm competitive within maybe 3 to 5%. We only work on about 30% on wine, about 18 to 20% on spirits, and these are gross margins; they're not net. So we're a volume-driven industry. We need to be very cognizant of the pricing structure, especially now that everybody has an iPhone or some sort of device where they can, what we call in the industry showcase, they can look at something and compare very rapidly. We've gotten to the point where, because of our philosophy of purchasing, we can be a small store and present a tremendous range, because I'm not fixed on buying a brand and buying it deep just to bring it to the shelf at a competitive price.
Right.
An example is typical of, and a lot of people don't want me to say this in the industry, but we all know it. You take a brand that's very popular, let's say a Scotch like Johnnie Walker Black. I like the product. I have nothing wrong with the product. We sell the double black, but I can't sell the regular Johnnie Walker Black unless I buy 35 cases. And that is a tremendous stress on a small store,
right?
Because we also have to pay our bill exactly within 30 days.
Mm.
That is something people in the real world don't understand. If we don't pay our bill in 30 days, we're put on a COD list, and no one can ship you with credit until that's paid.
Mm.
So we're very careful. The result is we have over 500 whiskeys on our shelves. You know, you have over 200 sakes to choose from. And it goes on and on. Champagne. We specialize in small production champagnes. One of the great reasons, besides the fact that it's much more interesting, the quality is better, there's more variance in style, is the fact that I don't have to buy a very large quantity.
Right.
If I want to buy Veuve Clicquot, for instance, or Moët & Chandon, it's 50 to 100 case commitment.
Right. And you don't have to go to your place. It can be anywhere. So there's
right.
no reason
exactly.
to come to your place.
So, you know, I try to speak to other people in our industry who are in the similar position I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we speak, you know, inevitably it comes up, how could you survive and be, you know, without these brands? And I say, well, if you have people on the floor who really are passionate about what it is that they do, if you are really careful about what you select and you present just a blinding array, people are going to come in here and they're going to take notice.
Right.
Even if they're not an expert or someone in the industry, when you walk downstairs and, you know, you look in our champagne room and they say, well, you don't have these? And I say, no, but I have 90 plus producers. The average store has maybe five, what I call the usual five,
right.
and a couple domestics. So it's working.
Right.
It's hard.
Mm.
It's very hard.
Well, and a lot of paperwork too.
as a result, we work with about, I would say on average every month, anywhere between 70 to 100 different distributors.
Wow.
It is a nightmare because it's a small check here, it's a small check there. But, you know, the work is worth it. It's worth it. I'll be one of the first people to sit down. Every year it comes up in our industry. People say, well, you know, the grocery stores may get wine. And I said, well, that's fine. Because they're not going to sell what I sell generally.
Right.
We make that commitment.
So then, you know, one of the biggest selections, of course, is the sake and shochu. So I want to hear that, you know, what got you, like John Gontner, convinced you how great it is?
John, I met John through a friend, a very good friend. And he said, Lenny, you know, you take care of everything in your store so well, but you don't have sake. And this was about, I'd say, almost 20 years ago. I said, well, you know, I never really tasted one I really liked. And he said, that's strange. He said, there are so many good ones. And I honestly hadn't been exposed. Met John, and we sat down, and he laid into me. He said, there's a world out there that most people don't know about. And I said, well, enlighten me. And we sat down, and we tasted. We went through every categories, and I was hooked. From there, I said, there is a world out there, and I think people... I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't present it and present it well. You know, I tell people who sell namasake on a shelf and not refrigerated is analogous to selling milk, you know, and putting it next to the boiler room. It was crazy what I was seeing. So I think we were one of the first. I'd say ourselves, probably Aster at the time. And there are a couple other stores since then who are selling sake. But I think we're one of the only ones that keep everything cold. You know, some of them are pasteurized. We understand that. But they remain fresher. And this is where the grocer understands. When I say the beer seller understands, they understand that beer can become tired or skunky, as we say. I think sake does the same thing. It shares those characteristics. If it's not kept in a cool place, and kept properly, or if it's not turned over rapidly, you know, it's most sakes don't age very well.
Right.
You want to have them fresh.
It's like a rosé, people say. It's in the season.
You know, some of them do age. I mean, we have some sakes that are aged, but they're the minority. We also make it a point not to order more than really 4 to 6 bottles. And that's because of the space in the refrigerator. It is a walk-in, but, you know, we still are limited. And we want to make sure that it turns. You know, it's not as popular as we would like it to be. So we're not going to go through cases like we would a wine product.
Right.
So we want to make sure it's fresh.
So if not, you have to drink it.
Absolutely.
Right. So right now, what are your criteria in selecting sake and shochu? Like, you know, I mean, they're not the millions, but about 4,000.
Yeah, there are so many, and more are coming to the market. What people don't understand who haven't been to Japan is that most people will drink local or sakes that are made within their prefecture.
Right.
And it's kind of rare to walk into a store within Japan, and if you are in Akita Prefecture and you will see sakes from all over, that's rare.
Right.
You will find sakes that are local. You'll see many, but they'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, we have a concentration. We're a focal point, like San Francisco, where sakes, I'm seeing sakes from everywhere. And we don't have a consistent sake clientele. It's very spread out. You have about half the sake consumers who are from Japan, who are living in New York, and they're going to be, I think their allegiance lies to where they're from. We understand that. Also, there are sake producers from very popular areas. So that's one customer. The other customer is the American customer, and that customer has a different flavor profile. They're definitely more open because they have no biases, because it's all new to them, or expectations.
Right.
But they tend to gravitate more towards the sake styles that are closer to what they're used to in wine. So you'll find sakes that have more of a melon or citrusy character will be far more appealing to the young sake drinker, the new sake drinker. I find those rich, creamy sort of dairy elements and the earthiness is favored by the seasoned sake drinker. So we're trying to appease and make two really different sake consumers happy.
Right.
So that is, so when you ask, well, what's our criteria? We can start with those two. And then we'll look at how many we can carry based on our space. And we'll say, okay, we're going to have this many in this category, this many in this category, and in this size, because we do like 1.8 liter. If people listening don't already know, in Japan, the 1.8 liter is the best size because you get the most value. In wine industry, you typically get about a 10 or 15% break if you get a larger bottle. But in sake, it's about a 30%.
Right.
So if you're used to, if you like something and you want to have it every day or you want to buy more, the 1.8 liter is definitely
right.
the way to
versus
go.
Versus regular 720 milliliters.
So we have to think about that. We take our more popular items and we'll buy a 1.8 if it's available. They're starting to become more popular here, but they still, the 720 is pretty much the standard in
most
stores.
It doesn't fit in the regular shelf, right?
Well, New York apartments are difficult because the refrigerators aren't that large and they are tall bottles, but having a walk-in refrigerator, we were able to design one entire wall that's about, I'd say, about 11 and a half feet high by about 10 feet long and about 2 feet deep that caters entirely to 1.8 liters.
Wow.
So we can have 50 to 60 1.8 liter sakes at any one time, maybe a few more during the holiday.
That's
if we
exciting.
Use the top shelf. So it is that was when we first opened and we started carrying sake, it was really only 720. Our refrigerator at the time couldn't handle it. When we built the new sake refrigerator about 4 or 5 years ago, we kept that in mind.
So, by the way, how many labels do you have, sake and shochu?
We average About 150 to 200. The reason why I say average, many of the productions are draft. Mm. So they come in and we get what we can get and then it's gone. Mm. We try to rotate the seasonals and you know, what people have to understand, many of these producers are very small, especially the ones we carry, because we're you know, we do have some brands, big brands like Kikusue or something like that. But then we also have very, very small producers like Shishida. Mm. And these, you know, the smaller producers may not have everything available all the time. Mm. And so from 150 to 200, I think is a safe estimate.
Huge.
It's huge. It really is. It's a lot to keep up. I just hired someone to kind of take the load off me a little bit, and he's taken a keen interest. His name is Mike Mahoney, and Michael is just came back from Japan, and he took his first trip there and saw the process up close, and he is also in charge of our cider. So, like I said, I find for some reason the cider, beer, and sake, that consumer seems to gravitate in those circles as opposed to wine. Mm. And Michael has a very good grasp of cider, and he's learning about sake. And he has, again, if I find someone on my staff who has a passion for something, above and beyond, I will let them run with it.
Right. Interesting, because sake, cider, and beer, they're all becoming craft.
Yeah.
Right? Value-added.
Absolutely.
So they are like it's not just alternatives, but it's like a star of the times.
It is. Right? Absolutely.
But speaking of, maybe you can give us an overview of the sake and shochu market, like a trend in this country.
I would say it's growing slowly. I think the biggest impediment to larger growth is really our system. We have a three-tier system in place in the United States, and it has its advantages and its disadvantages. Mm. The disadvantages are that you have many companies that have become entrenched. You have national distributors that can really keep products out of a market just simply by their size. If they choose not to take you, or you know, there's no one else to go to, or else, you know, your only alternative is to go to a very small company and hope that they can service you properly. And right now, most of my sake comes from Japanese companies that are also in food. So you'll see people like Wismedic or Mutual Trading, JFC. Right. These are all companies that also sell food and now have sake. Whereas the traditional distributor in New York, I could speak for New York, but around the country, tends to just be you know, like the largest is probably Southern Beverage. They do have a good sake selection, and it's growing. They're understanding it, and they're doing the best they can. But it's, again, when you're dealing with a very large company versus a very small, the small company could be much more nimble. Mm. And in a market where maybe less than 5% of the people who you're trying to sell it to actually purchase it, the big house may not be the best house. It, you know, maybe the big producer would like the big house because they're a little more generic. So that is the biggest impediment. It's our system. The other one, I can only speak for New York, is the retailer in New York. The retailer in New York has to make a commitment if they want to sell sake in the right manner. If they want to have growth, they have to have it, have the better sakes refrigerated. Right. They have to be cognizant of the turnover. I had a friend of mine who owns a store, and we used to meet for lunch when I was near his place, and we sat down, and he looked at me one day, and he was looking on his shelf, and he said, you know, that sake up there, I don't understand, why is it yellow? And I looked at him and I said, well, there's what's equivalent to a born-on date on the front, could you tell me what date that is? And he looked at me and he's reading it, and he said, wow. I said, that's about 4 years old. I said, yes. I said, that's the reason why it's yellow, and you really want that off your shelf.
Yeah, by definition, it's koshu, like old sake.
Exactly. You've made koshu. You know, and And many years ago, because the majority of people who were buying sake were from Japan, they would come into a store and they would look at that. And they wouldn't say anything. They would just politely say no thank you and would never come back to that store for sake. Right. And in fairness, the retailer did not know. Today, I think there's much more information out there. And the retailer has no excuse. If they are going to sell sake, they should do their homework. The grocer, I have to say, because I've seen them in other states, they're far more, I think they're far more with it. When it comes to that, because they're used to beer, there is a turnover issue, there is a refrigeration issue. They understand that, so they're not going to sell all these craft beers and keep them sweating on a shelf.
Right. So versus wine and spirits, they can keep there forever.
Interesting.
So, but sounds like sake sales has been growing.
It's been growing, and the growth is really because of the what we call the on-premise, your restaurants. The growth of fusion cuisine, of chefs and somms looking at sake in this category and expanding it, saying, you know, we can have sake with non-traditional foods. And people have this in their mind that I'm only going to have sake with sushi, and it makes me crazy. I can think of so many pairings, and that's what's happening, and that's what's fueling the growth. People go to a restaurant, they taste a sake that is well kept, and it's as fresh as it should be, and they're having it with foods they're more familiar with every day, and they're saying, "Wow, I would like to drink this every day," and that's what's fueling, I think, the growth, because unfortunately, it's not within the retail. It's not the retailer that's doing it. Sometimes I feel like I stand alone. There are a few, I should say, about five. And when you consider how many stores are just in the metro area, and there's only a handful, that tells you the uphill battle sake producers have. I mean, some sake producers have said, you know, I've had people who want to bring my product in, but I walked in their store and they have no refrigeration. I'm not going to sell it to them. I have to by law, but I'm not, you know, I really don't want to. That's a problem.
Right.
It's a big problem.
Interesting. And then those successful sommeliers and restaurants, they educate consumers and they realize, like, wow, sake is something
absolutely
interesting.
Absolutely. It's just broadening people's perspective and saying that this is just another form of alcoholic beverage that goes very well with food. Have this like you would a wine.
Right.
You know, I tell people, you know, put it in a white wine glass. Some of your better sakes, your ginjo and daiginjo. I just prefer most of my sakes in something like a wine glass because I want to get the aromatics. 90% of what we taste is through our sense of smell.
Right.
And you have to have the right glass.
So it sounds like we need to educate retailers. And
absolutely. And it, again, it comes back to the fact that, unfortunately, and it's a problem, and I've been very vocal about it within the retail community, is that you have many stores that are cookie-cuttered, that are, you know, they're owned, unfortunately, by one entity under different names, and they want to put the same thing in every store. And so when half your stores are doing that and they decide to only carry brands, you're not, as a boutique item or craft item, you're not going to do well. I mean, craft in when it comes to spirits is in right now. So, of course, people have jumped on the bandwagon. We've been selling craft whiskey for years. I've known Julian Van Winkle and the family for years before they sold it. You know, these are items that people couldn't give away, and now they're just crawling the walls for it. I laugh because these are things that I sold cases of, and you know, so this is you know, those types of stores will only do what's trendy.
Right.
They need to make a commitment, and so that leaves the remaining stores.
Right, and that's their efforts would make our consumers happy.
I think so.
Right.
I think the efforts would you know, make the consumer happy, but it also demands that you have to have people on the floor who understand the product.
Right.
You know, many stores you walk into, if they're brand-driven, the advantage of a brand-driven store is that the brand speaks for itself.
Right.
Most people who walk in there know it, they feel comfortable, and they purchase it right away. They not really don't ask many questions. Right. So these stores invest in that and not in their staff.
Mm.
As long as they're courteous and able to, you know, ring up the sale, that's as far as they go. It's
right.
really just two different types of retail operation.
Okay, right. So our past guests like Tim Sullivan, Tisconica, Hilton, those people are educating retailers too, but we need more of them.
We just need more retailers who have a passion for it, who
right.
really care about what they sell.
Mm.
Economics is a very big issue.
Right.
We all have to, at the end of the day, make money.
Mm.
And but it's finding that balance.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about how to pick a great sake at liquor store. So please stay with us.
And this one's called Relax, It's Just the End of the World by Tackstar. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Leonard Phillips, who is the owner of Ambassador Wines and Spirits in Midtown, which opened 43 years ago. Leonard took over the business in 2008 and made it into one of the best liquor stores in New York City. So some of my non-Japanese friends say sake labels are very hard to read, so they are discouraged to buy one. But some others say Japanese characters are so cool, so they like mysterious labels. So what's your advice to sake and shochu producers to design
outside
sake labels?
Outside of learning kanji or memorizing a few key characters, if a store has a serious selection and they take care of it, ask the people there. If you come into our store, that is the service we provide.
Mm.
The first thing we ask is, what kind of food are you going to have with it? How are you serving it?
Right.
What are your preferences? Do you prefer something? Are you having it as an aperitif?
Mm.
Are you serving it with a certain or a particular food? What do you like typically in wines? What do you like? So we try to draw parallels. And after about 3-4 minutes, we can get an idea of what it is you like. One of the philosophies that we have is it doesn't matter how expensive or how good a product is or what accolades it receives. If you don't like it, it isn't worth a thing.
Mm.
So it's very important that we come to understand what it is you like and how you're using it. So if someone comes to me and say, I'm having a casserole or I'm having something very rich, I will suggest something that's a little more traditional and not necessarily a higher grade sake. And that's something that people automatically tune to. They say, ooh, I want the daiginjo or ginjo. It's nice. They usually do represent the best of a house. But sometimes less is more. If you're having a particular food that I feel a regular junmai lends itself as a better pairing, I will recommend that.
So, yeah, the poor listeners are not familiar with the term. So junmai is less polished. The rice is remaining more. That means it may be more economical for the producers, but it contains more elements to express umami or other minerals.
It usually, they typically may have a higher acidity or amino acidity. So you have, you know, it may not be as soft. Usually it isn't. But for a dish that has a high fat content, it may be the right thing.
Right.
So if you have something, you know, using a let's say a fish, and you have something like a mackerel, it's oily, it's intense, it's strong, versus a very flaky white fish. That flaky white fish will lend itself, I think, better to something delicate.
Right.
So I may want to go to a much lighter style.
Like a fatty Wagyu beef.
Correct.
Because the Wagyu's oil, I heard the melting point is lower.
Is much lower, correct.
Right. So the robust junmai would be even better than the tonic.
Or one of my favorite, and typically they tend to be many ginjo grade, Yamahai. Yamahai is a longer, cooler fermentation, and they tend to make much richer style sake. And so I would recommend a Yamahai, and then I'll ask them, well, what is your preference? Do you want to have something warm or room temperature, or do you prefer? It's a different sensation. And that's what's interesting about sake, having a second aspect to things outside of just the typical flavor profile. It gives it an additional dimension. Japanese producers are really quite in tune with umami, understanding one of the aspects of nigori sake, it's not just that it's typically sweeter, that it has this texture.
Right. So nigori, for
savory quality.
It's like filtered.
Correct.
So there is like a lactic element.
Yeah, there is. It almost, as I say, a creaminess. We often associate this in the wine world with malactic fermentation. Typically, you notice it on white wines where a very popular New World style is to have 100% ml, as they say. It's very creamy and buttery.
Removing the sharp acidity.
Exactly.
So you only enjoy the buttery flavor.
Sake in itself has a much lower acidity than wine. So I think that savoriness is amplified because it has a much lower acidity. Typical acidity of about 1.8 on a scale is nothing compared to, let's say, a Riesling that's in the upper 9 to 10 level or a typical wine that's at about 5 or 6. These are orders of magnitude. And so being that the acid levels are much lower, the savory qualities do come out more and I think are more apparent. And many people often mistaken acidity for dryness. And this is where the sake meter value is so important because it relates density.
Right. So sake meter better sometimes, or more often, it's on the back label.
Correct.
Right.
And this is an indication, and it's a correlation. It's a broad indication to dryness. So if the sake meter value is really density, but they realize that, that also, if you have a SMV value that's above 5, your perception is much drier. So when we see karakuchi or dry, it's usually about a plus 7, and dai karakuchi is anything over 10. And then as you get to about, I would say about 1 to 2, it's neutral. And what's interesting about this value, I could take a novice sake drinker and give them 3 or 4 sakes of different SMV value and tell them after they taste it, now that is 7, that is 5, and then give them something that they know nothing about, they can pretty much, within about 1 or 2, tell you what that SMV is generally. It is very accurate. And I that was one of the things that, one of the first things that John Gottner taught me. Was the SMV.
So sake meter.
It's a very, very helpful gauge. And again, it really showcases the length at which the sake producer goes to understanding the product and trying to relate that to the consumer.
Okay. Right. So what you can find on the back label sake here in the U.S., I think sake mirabeau, hopefully.
Most people are putting it in English. It's usually on the front, but you have to know a little bit of kanji. But typically you'll see a plus and a number. And it's not always true, but even if you don't know the kanji, you can kind of pick it out.
Right.
You know, it's there. Mm. But if you memorize the kanji for that, it's easier to find.
But quickly, going back to that, you know, the Japanese character label versus non, like, you know, visible instant, which one is selling?
It's interesting. I believe in tradition. There is nothing more traditional in Japanese culture, or one of the few, that is uniquely Japanese than sake. And so, being a traditionalist, I believe that this label should remain the same. However, the back label should give you more information. And I have been with Mike Simkin at Shishishima. He brings that in. And we talked about this before he started representing them. And he really took what I said to heart. And you look at the back of every label that he has on the products he brings in, and it's wonderful. It gives you everything you want to know. And so that's helpful. And yet the front is still traditional. And so I think it's a nice balance.
Right. Yeah, actually, Kenji Tsushima of Tsushima Brewery, he came on the show,
that's
too.
That's wonderful.
So, but his mind is more, like, open, Western market-minded, even on the Asian market, too. So that's kind of model.
I think it should be the model. I think we can, you know, we go through a process bringing things to market. You have to present the labels, and they have to be presented to the TTB and for a label approval. Well, you're going through all that effort to do this. Why not just make a back label that shows everything? It's not that difficult. There's so much work going into it already. Reach a little more and put that back label on there.
Well, they have to produce the English one anyway, so just throw in one data, two data elements.
Absolutely, and I think it would make all the difference. It would help, especially in those places, unfortunately, who may be selling sake and have no one there to explain it to them. It would make it a lot easier.
Right. Okay, so this is the last question for you. So how do you predict the sake and shochu market in the next, like, 3, 5, 10 years?
I think it will grow steadily. Unless we run into something where where something is very trendy. Shochu had gone through that sort of trendy phase in Japan. And I don't think shochu will be as trendy because we have so much vodka here.
Right.
And but again, as long as we keep doing what we're doing, and we grow within the food industry, and that's all aspects, whether it's retailers or restaurateurs, we will see a steady growth. I think you'll see a steady growth of 3 to 5% per year. That's my prediction.
It makes sense because the food is globalized, and so should be the beverage.
Exactly. It'll follow suit. Unless a very large company takes a really big position and spends, you know, a great deal of money in marketing to make it this massive item. I think it's just going to grow slowly.
Right.
And it'll hit an inflection point where enough people are aware of sake and understand it that it'll finally reach that point.
I am so glad that you still exist and you're such an ambassador.
Thank you.
So where's the location of your store?
We're located on 1020 2nd Avenue. That's the corner of 54th and 2nd. You'll see a big blue awning. We're a real unique place. Please come by. Look forward to seeing you.
Yeah. Okay, listeners. So you get educated by going there and have fun.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And have fun.
Okay. So thank you for joining us today, Leonard.
Thank you.
So, listeners, if you'd like to know more about Leonard's shop, please visit theambassadorsofwine.com.
Ambassadorwines.com, correct.
Right. Okay. And what does the S, ambassador, S of wine?
No, it's just ambassadorwines.com.
Okay. Okay, so I just copy the link, but yeah, you can just Google.
Google it.
Wine spirits. Okay. All right, and if you have any questions or comments about the show, also suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write the review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Corin, and our engineer is David Tatasciore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.